Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro, and this week my guest is Charter School Academic Director, Joanna Harth. Joanna, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, John. How are you?
I am good. Thank you for joining me on the show.
Absolutely.
You are the Academic Director of a Colorado charter school, and I met you via a friend, and you are very familiar with computers and education. And so I thought this was a great opportunity to talk about computers in modern day schools, especially a charter school, and how the different kinds of computers fit in with maybe an Apple slant. So we'll get to that in a minute, but you've had kind of a roundabout career. Tell me about when you were growing up and where you grew up.
Yeah, absolutely. My family moved down to Costa Rica when I was little. Around 7 years old. So I went to school, elementary school and high school down in Costa Rica. And then I came back for college in California and stayed around here in the States.
Did you learn Spanish?
I did. I learned Spanish when I was down in Costa Rica. Absolutely. That was my everyday language down there. All my friends spoke Spanish. My mom's family is from Costa Rica. So my dad had to learn Spanish. My dad is German. So I clearly remember learning with him. We both learned Spanish at the same time.
Cool. What did your dad do for a living that took him to Costa Rica?
Well, actually, the reason we moved is because my mom wanted to go back to her family. She had quite a large extended family down there, and her parents were down there, my grandparents. So that was the main reason why. My dad was a tool and die maker, and he had a refrigeration factory down there in Costa Rica. Yeah, being that it's very hot, you can imagine that was a good business.
Did that technical influence from your father extend to your early interests?
Well, certainly. I grew up, you know, watching him work with machines, and I think that influenced what I thought I would do with the rest of my life.
So when you went back to California, what did you study?
I studied industrial engineering. And I've always loved organizing things, and I've always loved math, so I thought that was a good fit. And that's what I graduated. I have a bachelor's in science and industrial engineering.
Awesome, awesome. Well, I had a guest on recently, John Gustafson, who said math is the doorway. You can do anything you want if you do the math, because so many fields depend on math as their core, and if you do math well, then you can just about do anything else you want to do.
Oh, absolutely. And I also think it's a confidence builder. If you can do math, you are confident that you can do most things. And that certainly applies to education today. See that as important for the kids.
Absolutely. So you told me before that you were at UCSD and graduated with that degree in science and engineering. What did you do next?
Well, after that, I moved to New York and worked for a financial company there. This was a company that had a project moving some offices from Boston to New York. So I worked for them in New York.
So it was sort of administrative or logistics?
Not really. It was related to logistics, yes, because it involved their mutual funds department, and I worked in that department. And then we had to move those. They acquired another operation in Boston, and we had to bring in that operation into the New York office.
Had you met your husband at this point?
That's where I met him. He worked for the same company.
Oh, cool. School, but
yeah.
But eventually you ended up in Colorado. How did you manage that?
Yes, that was an interesting twist because I had never thought of moving to Colorado. I was very happy in New York. And my husband had taken a trip out to Colorado when he was in high school, and he loved it. So he came out to Colorado and got a job here. And much to his disappointment, that company moved him to New York. And after he worked here for a couple of years, and that's the company where we both worked at, and we met in New York. And then soon enough, he told me, yeah, but if we get married, we're moving back to Colorado. He wanted to be.
So you told me before that this was about this time you were thinking about having a family.
Correct. Yeah, we purchased our home and had our kids. And then I found that our home was a little bit far from where I was working. And that was really unsettling for the whole family. So I quit my job and stayed home with my kids.
You know, a lot of people struggle with the creation of their career and kids, but you told me a couple of days ago that you managed to finesse that really nicely. And you also mentioned that when it was time to get your oldest son into school, you had a happy experience with that.
Absolutely. You know, the stars were aligned. I feel I've been really fortunate with the way things have turned out, because I did suffer a lot when I had to give up my job and my career to stay at home with my kids. I never doubted that that was the most important thing to do, but it was also very painful, you know, as a woman to give up your career when you are, you know, just starting down that road.
Right.
But I did that. And when my kids were ready to go to school, I was fortunate enough to get them into a charter school. And after I had been there about a year, the principal tapped me and said, "Hey, I understand you speak Spanish. Would you like to teach Spanish at the school?"
One of those happy serendipities.
Exactly. It really was. And I told her that I knew nothing about teaching. I certainly speak Spanish, but I didn't know anything about teaching Spanish. And she said, "Well, that's okay, because I've hired a teacher from Argentina. And she is a teacher, and she will help you and support you and teach you everything you need to know so you can do that job." So I thought that was great, because it was extremely convenient. It was the same school that my children attended, and so we all had the same schedule, and that was perfect.
Not only was it a happy coincidence that you landed the job, but you had a mentor from Argentina who liked you and took you under her wings and helped you learn how to teach. That could have gone wrong, but it went great.
Absolutely. Like I said, I've been so fortunate. And we developed a very strong relationship. We are great friends. And to this day, she also works at the school. And we have a great partnership. And we're great friends. And she's a fabulous teacher. So I owe her my new career.
Yeah, it works out that way sometimes. When a person or a professor takes you under his or her wings, it can change your life. And this was another one of those situations. So you taught Spanish for a while, but then you told me that eventually a key opening happened.
Correct. So I taught Spanish for a while and got to know, you know, many of the parents and all the children. And charter schools are managed by a group of parents. So at a certain point, the school was hiring a principal. Now, our school had a different principal every year. It was a very unstable situation. So that particular year, the group of parents that managed the school wanted to hire two separate principals, because they had a business person in mind to lead the business side of the school.
I'm curious about that. Is that was hiring a business person to run the school something that the parents cooked up, or is this kind of standard practice and a good thing to do in a charter school?
It is not standard practice. It is something that they decided to do because they could see that there were two distinct sides to this job. and they were having difficulty finding one person that could do both things. And that stands to reason because they're two very different sides of the job. You know, the business and administrative operation, and then the academic side of the job. So they decided to cut it in half and have two jobs. And I applied for the academic director position and was fortunate enough to get it.
And how long have you been doing that?
Well, I've been doing that now for about 12 or 13 years. I've been with the school now for 20 years and haven't looked back since.
Are you having fun?
I love it. I love it. Every day is an adventure.
Did you ever dream when you were in your bachelor's degree studying science and engineering you would do this?
Never, not for a minute. And you can imagine that for a woman that wanted, you know, to be an engineer and studied engineering, children were really not anything that I was very interested in at the time. So if you would have told me at the time, I would have said, no, you're absolutely wrong. You know, I'm not interested in schools. But I have actually found that it is a perfect outlet for my engineering because schools need to be very organized places. So I absolutely use my engineering skills every day.
You know, it kind of reminds me, that arrangement you described, kind of reminds me of a military operation, especially on small ships. You have the captain who is responsible for the strategy and the management of the ship overall and the big, you know, the maneuvering decisions and strategic decisions. And then you have the executive officer who often handles the administrative side and watches the captain, and he's in training. But he handles more personnel issues. And can often be strong in engineering too, but the teamwork, the two working together, cover all the bases and learn from each other. So that's very interesting. Very interesting.
Absolutely. And you know, the director and I, we have a fabulous relationship and a fabulous working partnership. And I think we have been fortunate in that too, because like you said, we can discuss things. We often do visioning sessions of where we're going with the school, things that need to be done, and then we get to work. But it's fortunate that there's two of us because it does allow us to talk about where we're going. Otherwise, it would be a very lonely job.
Yeah, that's true. Somebody to confide in, somebody to team with. Do a lot of charter schools do that, or are you guys unique?
I think we're pretty unique in that. And it is a format that I recommend other schools do. And many schools that are very large have many assistant principals. So I think it might be a similar thing. If the assistant principals are charged with the academics, which is not always the case.
Right.
But in our case, I think, you know, having two people allows us to discuss and do, you know, corrections along the way and discuss, hey, you know, what's happening with this? Maybe we should do this. Well, maybe that. It allows for good visioning for the school.
Do the parents like the idea when they come to meetings of sitting down and talking to two people who are partnering? Does that make them pleased?
I think so, because it allows for, you know, different personalities to find a person that they can more easily talk to. You know, so either the principal or myself. Sometimes there's parents that want to just talk to me. Sometimes they just want to talk to her. Sometimes, you know, we have to get together and do a larger meeting. But I think it allows for a larger outlet for parents. And also the simple equation of time. There's two of us.
Sure.
So, you know, odds are you're going to find one of us at any given time.
Cool. Well, along the way, you've learned quite a bit as being the academic director about computers in schools, which is what I want to talk to you about next. And you've learned an awful lot, and that's going to be a very interesting discussion. But first, we need to take a short commercial break. So, folks, we'll be right back in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thank you, Kelly. We're back. I'm chatting with Johanna Harth, a charter school academic director here in Colorado. And now I want to transition to asking you a lot of cool stuff about how you guys handle your computers. The backdrop here is that for years now, there's been a discussion at the Mac Observer about Apple in education, the use of iPads, the popularity now of Chromebooks, how schools buy and utilize computers. And we're going to get into all that. So let's start at the beginning. Your school covers kindergarten through eighth grade, right?
Correct.
When do the students first get exposed to computers?
Starting early on, the first month that they arrive in school in kindergarten.
Oh my, really?
Absolutely. Yes.
I was using crayons in kindergarten.
This is a very difficult task for them.
What do they... Okay, so walk me through the introduction of these computers, and I'll ask you about what kind they are in a second.
Okay, so the children are assessed academically three times per year. And the very first time at the beginning of the year is an important assessment because it establishes a baseline for the kids. So the whole student population is assessed in September, and so are the kindergartners. And the assessment is web-based, so the kindergartners have to access this assessment using a laptop.
So that brings up the subject of what kind of laptop do you guys favor these days?
Well, these days we are into Chromebooks, John.
That's going to send reverberations through the listeners.
Yes.
But we've heard it before, and that's why I wanted to have you on the show, just as a reaffirmation and a punctuation. What is the appeal of these Chromebooks?
First and foremost, the cost. As a public school, you know, we don't have a lot of funding, and we do have the need to bring technology in and have all the students being able to access technology. So a combination of both those factors, having the technology and the cost, has brought us to purchasing Chromebooks for the building.
What do the kindergartners do with the Chromebooks as soon as they log on?
Well, believe it or not, John, we have to start by teaching them how to log on.
And remember their password. Do they write it with a crayon in the palm of their hand?
It is, I have to tell you, it is the funnest experience to go in there on the day that they have this assessment.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of adults in the room on that day. Many teachers assist because every kid needs help. And one of the funny things is that they, you know, they're instructed to open the Chromebook, and immediately they touch the screen. And immediately their little hand goes up saying, "Mine is broken. It's not working." Because they have been exposed to tablets at home. So they want to manipulate the Chromebook the same way they manipulate their tablet.
Is that a problem, or is that something that you just gently, you know, guide the students through and say, well, this is a different kind of computer. We're going to do it this way.
Yes, absolutely. We teach them. And, you know, one of the things we discovered early on is that the kindergartners are not very good with trackpads. So we had to buy mice for them that are tiny so that they can use the mice instead of the trackpad. Now, there are some children that have been exposed to laptops at home mm-hmm. and use the trackpad. And in that case, kids do prefer to do that. And we can tell, you know, soon enough. And during that first assessment, you know, who can use the trackpad and who's going to have to use the mouse.
You know, in the Apple community, we're enthusiastic about iPads, and many people see that as the machine of the future. But, you know, the mouse is 40 years old, I think, or something like that, and maybe 30. And it turns out that the mouse is still a remarkable pointing tool. It really is. It stands the test of time.
Absolutely, and it's also easier to manipulate when fine motor is not completely developed, like kindergarten age children.
Oh, right. That sounds very sensible.
Right.
Was there ever a time when you tried to use more expensive, say, MacBook Airs or something like that?
Oh, absolutely, John, because when we started, when the school started, we have always been an Apple environment. And as a matter of fact, even today, every single teacher has an Apple laptop. And our computer labs, which we have two of them, have Apple desktops. So we certainly started down that road, and our first purchase of laptops was an Apple Card. So these are the big cards that you plug in, and they are full of laptops.
Oh, they have like the slots where you drop it in, and it's charging stations and all that, and rolls around on wheels.
Exactly.
How much did that cost?
Well, those Apple cards cost around $40,000.
Oh, my. How many MacBooks were in that cart? Do you remember?
There's 24 in that cart, or 25, one for the teacher. And we just could not sustain that kind of expense, John. So at the beginning, when we had to buy one, when we started, you know, technology exploded and we said we have to get laptops for the kids, you know, we bought the first one and we bought three. By the time we
bought three carts.
Yeah. Time we bought the third one, we realized that we were not going to be able to sustain that kind of expenditure. $40,000 per cart was just
right.
More.
That's $1,600 per computer. Wow. Compared to the Chromebooks. Did you tell me how much you pay for the Chromebooks? I forgot.
$300 per unit.
And how do they stand up? Are the Chromebooks fairly rugged?
You know what? They really are. They really are rugged. The first thing to know is that, you know, if a kid... we have a contract that the kids sign at the beginning of the year saying that they have to be careful using the equipment and that if they break it, they owe the school a new Chromebook. But I have to tell you, in the 3 years that we have been using Chromebooks, we've had that happen one time. And the one time the student dropped the machine and the screen broke and our IT guy changed the screen and it's working perfectly fine.
Wow. So does the place where you buy the Chromebooks offer like the replacement displays that are really easily installed? Is that how it works?
Yeah, we have an IT person that is fabulous, and he has a little workstation there, and he's constantly, cleaning and repairing and keeping the machines up to speed. But they are pretty rugged because we have 700 students in the building using those Chromebooks day in and day out.
What is the ratio of students to Chromebooks?
Yes, in the elementary, kindergarten to sixth grade, we have one Chromebook for every three students. And in seventh and eighth grade, we have one for every two students.
Does that mean that when the student is not using the Chromebook, they're in some other class like history or English or something?
Correct. If a kid is not using it, there's some other kid that's using it at that very time. So these are machines that are being used, I would say, you know, 7 or 8 hours per day.
Was there ever a time when the school considered doing a BYOD, bring your own device, where the parents had to pay for the computer? And what would the implications of that be? Would it be that you wouldn't have standardization or the parents weren't willing to pay? Did you ever think about that?
Absolutely. We talked about that a lot. And we decided that the most important thing is that our academic program does not require that the student use technology every minute of the day. So that was one consideration. The second consideration was control over the technology. Allowing every student to bring their own devices, the systems have to be a little different so we could manage who has access to the internet and when and what are they looking at, firewalls and all that. So in considering all those factors, we decided that we wanted to have control of the technology ourselves. So the students don't take the laptops home. They stay at school there, and they know it's school equipment.
How technically savvy are the students as they grow older? You mentioned to me the other day that perhaps some of the teachers might even be behind, you know, the fifth or sixth graders. Are students today coming in to school, aside from the kindergartners who are maybe a little bit young, are they coming in pretty technically savvy about computers and Wi-Fi and files and storage and stuff like that?
Absolutely, John. We call them, we always say that the students are digital natives, and we are not. The teachers are not. And even though we have pretty young teachers in the building, and they are certainly more savvy than the older teachers in the building, the first thing that we do every year is have all kinds of technology training for the teachers. The teachers always need to be supported in the use of the equipment and in the use of applications and different systems for assessment or evaluation. So it's a constant learning curve with the teachers. But the students are digital natives, and they don't see it as anything very difficult. So we always laugh because if anything fails in a classroom, the students are the ones that know what's wrong and how to fix it.
Do they ever complain that you don't provide them with iPads to, you know, maybe have more fun with? Is there a role for iPads at all in the school?
There is a role for iPads, and as a matter of fact, this past year we purchased an iPad cart that the teachers can check out. We find that it is an instrument that the younger students like to use because there's many apps that are fantastic for the iPad. There's some apps about, for example, the human body or math or language or whatever topic you want to introduce. And there's all these apps that the kids enjoy working on. But it is not a primary instrument of instruction. In other words, it's truly a bell and whistle. It is not something that we need to do a good job teaching the students.
Interesting. But you do have, in addition to the iPad cart, you have a tech lab where there are some, is it iMacs?
Absolutely. We have two tech labs, and both of them have Apple products. One has Apple laptops, and the other one has desktops. And the students attend technology class during the week, depending on their age, from once a week to every other day for the older kids. And that's truly where they learn to use the computer and use programs that they're going to need in the future.
So let me see if I got this right. The iPads and the Mac desktops are supplemental and used for specific purposes, but in terms of the overall teaching requirements and testing and exposing the students to the keyboard and proficiency in typing and ruggedness, the Chromebook is this heavy lifter. Did I get that right?
Correct. So as far that the Chromebook is the instrument used in all the classrooms to support education, and Apple desktops and laptops in the lab support really the specific education of technology for the kids. That's where we teach them how to type, where we teach them, some programs, Excel and Word. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's where the teaching of those particular subjects happens.
Here's the bingo question. Would you say that your utilization of Chromebooks in a primary role is something typical across Colorado in your experience?
Yes, absolutely.
So it's not just your school. It's something that the state of Colorado supports, especially because of some of the testing required, right?
Correct. So what's happened to us is that the Department of Education advised us a few years ago that we would be testing the students once a year, every year, using web-based assessments. So we need to have enough equipment in the building so that the students can take these assessments. So that's where the Chromebooks come in.
All right, I want to move on to the next subject, programming. You told me that you do have a scenario for kids to learn programming. You have this online service. What was that?
Yes, absolutely. I'm taking a look at our curriculum map that we have for technology, and I see that third, fourth, and fifth graders use something called Scratch for programming. And then older kids also learned HTML because they start dabbling in web design.
How old are they again?
When they start HTML in sixth grade.
Oh, my goodness.
Right.
Now, is this typical, again, across Colorado, or is this a charter school advanced notion?
I tend to think that this is not necessarily typical. But in the district where our school is, we try to match to high school requirements. And, of course, our vision is that when our students get to high school, they're able to place in many advanced classes. So we coordinate with the high schools to make sure that we are teaching what the students are going to need.
So here they are moving into high school. They've been to the charter school. They know how to handle a notebook. They know how to type on a real keyboard. They've been exposed to some programming principles. So they're in pretty good shape.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They know spreadsheets. They know how to produce a good document. They have learned all kinds of presentation programs like Google Slides or PowerPoint or there's different programs out there for presentations. So absolutely, they've been trained in many kinds of programs.
One of the topics that's a little bit touchy, and I know my readers have brought this up, and that is a lot of schools use Google Docs, and that's kind of a semi-sensitive area. Do you use Google Docs? And if you do, how do you handle the privacy issues?
Well, absolutely, John. I have to tell you, we are a Google environment. And the main reason for that is that our district is a Google environment. So the students are assigned a Google account the minute they walk into kindergarten. And that's how we communicate with parents. That's how, we use the Google for Education suite. So Google Classroom, for example, Google Calendars for the students to see what's coming up in homework or tests. So certainly we're a Google environment. And along with that has the issue of privacy is a topic of the day. So the state of Colorado has put out the an act called the Student Data Transparency and Security Act. And our district and our school, in consequence, is having to comply with that this year.
Excellent. I like that. I like that. Hooray for Colorado.
Correct.
So it sounds like Google has pretty much provided a lot of your infrastructure in terms of the online document management and the Chromebooks. Do you have an Apple rep? Does he ever call on you? Does he seem worried about this? Do you have any discussions with him or her? What's that relationship going?
Yes, John, you're going to be disappointed by this answer.
No.
The Apple, I don't know who our Apple rep is. They never interact with us. You know, and of course we're not, you know, a huge school, but we're not a tiny school. We have 700 kids. So, you know, it's an account that they might like to have, but I have no idea who our Apple rep is.
Who is it that calls on you the most? Who is it who's closest to you, calls you on the phone once a week, says, how can I help? What are you doing? What do you need?
all our curriculum providers, Pearson, Houghton Mifflin, Amplify, these are all, you know, they are set up. They have local reps in my hometown. These are people that stop by, you know, bring samples. What do you need?
You know, and
it would be awesome to have a relationship like that with Apple, but the reality is we don't. I mean, even Google, for example, a couple of years ago, they introduced Google Explorations, and they came out to our building and set up a big, activity for the students. And, but we don't have that kind of relationship with Apple, unfortunately.
That's sad to hear. Sad to hear. And I add a personal note on this? My wife is a professor at a community college, and she's slowly seeing the MacBook Airs disappear, and they're slowly being replaced by Surfaces with keyboards and a smattering of Chromebooks. And it's just because of the basic financial issue. I mean, even though they can buy a MacBook Air in the college bookstore for $599 and an Office 365 for 1 year, $599 is still a hefty chunk of change when you can buy a Chromebook or a used PC notebook for $250 to $300. So
absolutely,
students are very sensitive to that. That's it's sad to hear about that, but maybe this will rattle some cages. I wanted to ask you, as we're coming to the close of the show, we don't have a lot of time left, but I wanted to ask you, you teach computer savviness, and you teach the students how to use computers to create documents and to learn. But do you also teach them about computers, how they work and how to handle them?
Yes, absolutely we do. And the students are very interested. So when we take computers out of line, because they're very old, we either give them away to our kids, but we set a few aside so we can take them apart with the kids. So we have a few STEM classes, science, technology, engineering, and math. And those students in particular always want to know how things work. But we also do that with our elementary ed kids, say in fifth grade on up, where we take apart one of the computers and look at all the components and what goes into it. So certainly it's something that the students should know about.
What about keeping the kids safe as they peruse the internet? Is there any initiative there?
Oh, John, that is a hot topic, because there is a lot of danger out there for the students. So we absolutely try to teach our students to be digital citizens, to be good digital citizens. And we teach them about the dangers out there, what information you never share, and also, they themselves, what is harmful and hurtful that they should not be doing. And we also collaborate with our local police department, and they also have a program, and they come out twice a year to teach all our students.
Oh, cool.
Dangers of that lurk out there in the internet.
That's awesome. Well, I wish I had gone to your charter school. It sounds amazing.
We think it's an amazing place, John. Come and visit sometime.
All right, I will. Well, we've come to the end of the show, and we've run long, but I hope the listeners enjoyed this, because there was a lot to discuss about kids and computers and education and how Apple fits in and doesn't, and this business with Chromebooks we've all heard about. And it was fascinating to hear your particular story about how you match your curriculum needs to the computers. It was awesome discussion. Well, thank you for being on the show. It was great.
You bet. It was my pleasure, John.
Listeners, I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll see you next week on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.